My name's Leanne. I'm a compulsive eater.
Hi, Leanne.
Hi, everyone. My home meeting is Westfield. So much as I enjoy this meeting, it is a little bit of a ride for me. But it's fine. It's fine. So when I found out that I needed to do some service this morning, I was thinking about steps 10 and 11. And when I boil step 10 and 11 down, step 10 tells me that I need to moderate my behavior. And I need to moderate my behavior because otherwise I'm going to have a lot of crap at the end of the day that I'm going to regret. And when I regret, that's a strong emotion. It's a negative emotion. And I have one antidote for strong negative emotions, and it's food. And I no longer choose to eat. So it kind of means that I have to moderate my behavior by not doing the things that I always did. I would describe myself, you know, the term bulldozer was used today. I would describe myself as a bull. I would just bull forward. I would just pound through. I was so self-absorbed. I had no understanding of other people's feelings. I didn't identify with their point of view. I remember having a thought in high school that I couldn't understand how some people were different than me. And then I got out of high school into college, and people were even less different than me. And then I got out of college into the workforce, and people were all over the map. And all of a sudden, I was in this world, and I didn't have the rules. I didn't have the tool set. I didn't know how to navigate. I wanted everybody to be black or white. I was just talking to someone on the phone about this, because they were saying that they wanted everyone to be black or white. And I'm like, I'm just the same way. I wanted everyone to be black or white. You're black or white. You're good or bad. You're a good person or a bad person. I get along with you or you piss me off. I had to put people in boxes with boundaries on them because my behavior was very volatile and I was not responsible or accountable for my behavior. There's a wonderful phrase in the Big Book that is restraint of tongue and pen. And someone read that in a Big Book study meeting that I go to at my home group. And that one phrase, restraint of tongue and pen, spawned a one-hour continuous share. And everyone in the room is sharing restraint of tongue and pen. And I started to realize, you know, someone would send an email at my first big job, and this is in the mid-80s. I came in 2001, so I've got a lot of pre-program history to own up to. And, you know, they would write an email that I felt, and, you know, this is in the early days of email. I mean, really, you know, pull yourself way back, remember when. And I would write this email, and I would agonize over this email because I had to give back as good as I got. It was real important to me. I was in a constant state of mood swings, from euphoria to rage, from controlling to more controlling. I was never at peace. I was never present. I was looking forward to events, and when I'm thin, my life will change, and when I get the promotion, my life will change, and when I get the next job, my life... It was all about what was going to happen down the road, you know. I never looked back, except to beat myself up for mistakes I had made. And it was very hard to reconcile the fact that I had made mistakes with my imagination that I had to be perfect or nobody would love me or want to be with me. So I never really knew my own feelings. I was always swinging from one extreme to the other. And it wasn't until, oh God, maybe 3 or 4 years ago in program that I realized that these swings were incredibly, incredibly for the purpose of serving this disease. And by having a procrastination till the 11th hour, whacking something out, doing a really good job in, you know, half or a quarter of the time that a normal person would require, I could look like a hero. I was sucking up adrenaline. And I was then able to plunge into a binge, like diving into a cool lake on a hot summer's day. And I realized that my binges were perpetuated by these emotional mood swings that I was going through. And I was just God, whatever came into my mouth, there's no God involved, whatever came into my head went out of my mouth or out in an email. And I burned so many cycles and so many thoughts and so many minutes and hours and days in the what if game that I wasn't present in my own life. And I certainly wasn't happy. So I came in a program and I got a sponsor, and the sponsor told me that I was going to read and write every night, and that I was going to call her, and I was going to call her on time and give her my meeting, reading and writing, and I was going to give her my food. And all of a sudden, I'm not sitting in front of the TV every night. So that little moderation in my behavior made me be fully present for the time that I was working on my new program. And the nightly binges were moderated because I wasn't in the kitchen anymore. I wasn't sitting in front of the TV set like a brain-dead fool, just zoning out and eating. And I started to realize that the days that I kept myself more centered were the days that I had better days. So we finally, I get to step 10, and I started to understand that step 10 is about moderating my behavior, because I thank God that I am not shy about making amends today. I am not the least bit shy. I have to clean it up or carry it. So if I have to make an amends, I make an amends. But it's so much better if I get that little moderation in advance so that I don't have to make the amends. You know, I love the phrase in the Big Book, the grouch and the brainstorm are the dubious luxuries of mortal men. That tells me that even though normal people can do it and get away with it, I can't. I'm an addict. I use these behaviors to get into my disease, to get into my self-justification, and the self-justification turns into binge justification. And then I go into denial. What is that? Don't even know I am lost? I don't know. Lying. Yep. So I don't want to be in denial anymore. I want to be my authentic self, living my authentic life. I want to find what I need to do. I want to find my boundaries. I still don't really have a good sense of my boundaries. This week, I have been working on something. My boss gave me something to do that was a sort of a longer-term project. And I said, well, what about if we do a piece of it right now? And his eyes lit up, you know, because there's all kinds of upside to do the small piece now. But the timeline is really tight. And I got loaned a couple of resources. And they're coming at stuff from a particular perspective, which happens to be different than my boss's perspective. And so I was trying to get in front of my boss with our, you know, first draft work product, and he's been focused on something else, which is entirely his prerogative. But I felt on the call that we had on Tuesday with some folks from all around the world that he threw me under the bus. And I got highly annoyed. And I kept going, Leanne, take deep breaths. I'm on a conference call, I'm on my headset, sitting at my desk going, just trying to bring my intensity level down so that I can have a human conversation and not sound like a lunatic. So bottom line, you know, he expressed his point of view, I expressed my point of view. Other people on the phone finally got to express their point of view. And that afternoon, I knew that I had an amends to make. And thankfully, my boss had put time on the calendar to talk about something else, and I walked over. You know, I didn't have to go over specially, but I would have. And I walked in the door and I said, Scott, you know, I owe you an apology. I said, I really had no, I was totally caught off guard and I overreacted and I'm really sorry. And he said, no, he said, actually, I owe you an apology. You've been trying to get in front of me all week with this and I haven't made the time. How cool is that? I'm not saying that I am self-justified in having overreacted, because that's not the person that I want to be or where I want to live. But it does happen. And you know what? I have zero resentment toward this man. And it was lifted the same day. So when I look back on my day on Thursday night, I didn't have to say, I'm going to make an amends tomorrow. I was honest. I was open. I was unjustified, and I need to make an amends, and the amends is made, and we're fine. You know, we're fine. And, you know, the relationship feels stronger because I feel like I was able to be completely honest, and then I was able to listen to his perspective and where he was coming from, and I get that too now. Because I get the gift sometimes from a higher power, because I could never do it before, of empathizing with where somebody else is coming from. You know, I work with people all around the world. I work with people in India. I work with people in the UK. I work with people in Australia, in Singapore, in Malaysia, Indonesia. I mean, there's, you know, 104 countries. I don't talk to all of them all that often, but I talk to a number of them frequently. And everybody's a different person, and it doesn't matter, you know, if you're a Buddhist or a Muslim or a Christian. Every person is a unique person, and every perspective is a unique perspective. And I don't have the right to sit in judgment like I used to most of my life. So the thing that I started doing fairly recently, I've realized that asking to be the best that I can be today is kind of hooking back into my whole perspective of perfection. And so I ask God just to be reasonably good. Let me be reasonably good today. Let me do a reasonably good job. Let me be focused on what I'm supposed to be focused on. I love the recommendation in the OA 12 and 12 that talks about the need to be present and to have that conscious contact and to have God give me a heads up on whether I'm going to take the right action or not. You know, when in doubt, I pause and I say, God, if I'm supposed to do this, make me want to really, really do it. And if I'm not supposed to do this, make me not want to do it. Show me your will by adjusting my attitude. And then I just stop thinking about it and put it to one side. And, you know, that intuition comes to me and I realize what the path is supposed to be. And it keeps me out of trouble. It keeps me off the amends list. It keeps me out of making mistakes during the day that would happen if I had just bowled forward and done my old usual stuff. Which nicely brings me to step 11. You know, sought the prayer and through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Well, the God of my understanding is not the God I had when I walked in here. I had that, you know, sort of gray-bearded guy sitting on a throne, sort of looking very disapprovingly down at me because I was never good enough. I could never do what I was expected to do. And, I mean, I look back, I think I must have been the most goody-two-shoes little brat that there was, you know. I was very compliant. I had excessively good manners. I think that was a point at which I may have started to detach from my authentic self. And I don't know when the food came in for me, and I don't know when it was that I stopped growing up, but somewhere along the line I stopped growing up, and I started using food, and I stayed stuck there for a very long time. You know, and this is despite having, you know, a responsible job that paid a good salary and a you know, wonderful husband and two wonderful children, you know, and the house and the car. And, you know, excuse me, all of that had no relationship with the fact that I felt like I was irresponsible, not good enough, and not grown up. So I had this you know, gray-bearded God on a throne guy. And I read the thing in the big book that talks about, you know, who are you to say there is no God? You know, that you know, earth-shattering moment. And I realized that I didn't have to get stuck with that definition. You know, that guy that sort of frowned down and looked at me overeating going, that wasn't a useful God for me. That wasn't a good image. I got told to act as if by one of the sponsors I've had over the years. And I started to see that just acting as if was a mood alterer, attitude changer, game changer for me. And if I act as if there is a God, then that means I'm going to stop and pray before I take an action. Whether or not I believe, the belief is on the side for right now. I'm just doing an exercise. I'm told do an exercise, so I'm doing the act as if exercise. So if I'm supposed to be doing this exercise, I'm going to be acting as if I have a God. I'm going to be checking in with a God. God, hello, I don't know if you're there, I don't know if you can hear me, whatever. But I'm supposed to pray to you in the morning, so I'm praying to you in the morning. And please help me focus on my program today, help me be a nice person, help me do service, and help me to be what I'm supposed to be today and where I'm supposed to be today, if you're listening. And that's what I did, you know, and I started to try and be a little more enthusiastic and a little less skeptical as I went through this act as if exercise. And I got the message that I should be grateful. So I started to say gratitudes. I had a public transit commute at that time, and I was going to the Newport station in Jersey City. I'd get off the path, and I'd come up, you know, right across the river from Manhattan. And when you come up out of that path station, there's this ramp, and it looks like it's going straight up. And you walk up this ramp, you know, and you feel the backs of your legs pulling, and you're like, good. You know, I was about, I don't know, probably about 40 pounds heavier at that point. And it was a lot, you know. And as I went up the ramp, I'm surrounded by people, but I don't know any of them. So I'm in my own head, and I'm talking to God, and I'm saying, God, today I'm grateful for. And I just say in this little litany of all the things I was grateful for as I trudged up this heavy ramp that should have been a staircase. And I started to get this sensation that this new higher power that was just light and love was sitting on my shoulder. And I would come out of the path station into the sunshine, and I would feel this presence. And I'm like, maybe I don't have to act as if anymore. So what I have to do is I have to do my program. I talk about my program routine. I have to check in with God in the morning. I have to do my reading, I have to do my writing, I have to plan my food, I have to give it away. And that's what I do. I do it every day. When I can't do it in my normal time frame, I find myself getting a little edgy and nervous. Spontaneous Leanne has a crutch. Well, I'd rather the program crutch than the food crutch. Then during the day, I try to remember to check in with God. I don't always pray before I eat. I try to pray. I ask that the food be blessed, I ask my intentions be blessed, and I ask to be present while I eat. Because I eat at my desk a lot, and that, you know, computer screen is right there. So I have to ask to be present, because I find myself drifting away. A friend of mine always says, stay here, stay here, stay here, to herself during the day. And I find myself using that also, stay here, God be with me, and let me be willing. Is the prayer that I most often pray in the morning. You know, willing to go the extra mile for another person, willing to do service when I'm asked, or volunteer, take some responsibility when I'm not asked. You know, do the piece of work that nobody wants to do. You know, clean the bathroom at a Unity Day. I wound up doing that. I said, what needs to be done? Someone said, the bathroom. So I said, okay. I'm not real big about cleaning my own bathrooms, I'll tell you right now, but I clean those. And I'm not nominating myself for sainthood here, because I think that the point I'm trying to make is it's possible to be in the moment and to be completely willing when the conscious contact is there. You know, and the conscious contact for me is always there if I ask for it. It's not always there if I allow myself to get, you know, completely sucked into my busyness. I mean, that's what business is, right, is busyness. And so I need to be mindful that my first job is to be a servant of God and to be a human being. And then all the other stuff comes after that. You know, making sure the dishes go in the dishwasher and the counters get wiped and my kids take the trash and the recycling out and somebody walks the dog. I mean, this is all stuff that I do every day, but it's not what I focus on anymore. You know, I used to think I had a good day if the to-do list got done, you know. And today my to-do list is still important, but it's a different to-do list. And it's got, you know, step 10, check in the morning, check out at night. And it's got step 11 in the morning and then hopefully through the day. I really appreciate these handouts, too. I really like the notion of doing some of this stuff way more consciously. And I, too, have bought a journal. I'm in the middle of a journal, and I'm compulsive enough that I have to finish the journal I'm in the middle of before I go to the... You know, I don't make this up. This is who I am. Oh, well. All I'm trying to do today is stay here and be present. So thanks for letting me share.
Well, I want to thank all our speakers here today for this. And I guess I'm just going to say I wrote a little essay here. A while back, I don't even remember when I wrote it, and it is about these steps. It says, what is the price paid that is paid for recovery? We know that the price of addiction, any of us can recall our past and see the wreckage of our addiction. which is the price we paid thus far. For if we are not forgiving, yielding, and surrendering to our addiction, then perhaps we are not finished. The price of recovery is, in part, our price of addiction, but more so the admission of powerlessness and unmanageable of our lives in thought and action. Recovery is also the need to have a spiritual experience as a solution. To accept spiritual solution and work, we have to clear the path to God because it is blocked by our addiction in thought and actions. Accepting this means working through the process of the 12 steps. It means accepting the solution of the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, in its entirety. The solution of the big book proposes radical changes in body, mind, and spirit. Although it appears difficult, the process is simple. It is the view of the addict that perceives it as insurmountable. However, once the process is begun and taken to its end, the price seems quite small for the blessings of rebirth. The price of maintenance of a spiritual solution is the real price. Just because we have become recovered from addiction by a spiritual solution does not mean we are cured. The recovered person must continue to maintain and clear the path to their higher power. This means constant vigilance and pursuing the work necessary. Steps 10 and 11 provide the constant connective avenue for the recovered addict. The 12th step is vital because of the failure to pass this on to another makes this process of recovery nothing. The point is to live on a spiritual basis and not to settle for spiritual progress. The goal is spiritual perfection. The price is to continually pursue this, to know that it is very unlikely that we will reach it, but we must reach for the stars. For we are not second-class citizens because we are addicts. We deserve the best, and we can have it if we are willing to have a relationship with God and have a spiritual experience. There's copies of this if you want it up here. And I think if we have any questions, we'll just open up. Matt?
Hi. The question I have is I'm thinking about possibly limiting or severing a personal relationship I've had for over 20 years with a good friend of mine. He's a lot older than me, so he kind of be very parental and very controlling and very abusive. I believe that he's an undiagnosed alcoholic because of some of the behaviors that I've experienced by talking with other OAers and friends of mine in the program. How can I apply steps 10 and 11 to that to get the willingness to make the decision?
I can take that. I would look at OA 12 and 12, and I would look at, don't have the page number off the top of my head, but there's a lovely passage. It's in, I think, step 7. It's in my handout from a few weeks back. Definitely, the quote itself is in the handout. And it asks, you know, you can write it on a daily basis or pray on a daily basis to ask for the willingness to do God's will. And ask that God increase your willingness to take that step if it's God's will that you take it, or decrease your willingness if it's God's will that you not take it. And just, you know, the answers will come if we seek them. So that's what I have. Thank you.
The only other advice I would have is whenever I find myself in contention with another person, I try to take a very careful inventory of my own behavior in that relationship. For two reasons. One, to make sure that I am indeed being harmed, and two, to make sure that the behavior that got me into the relationship won't get me into a relationship with a similar person.
Any other questions? Well, I want to thank our speakers for sharing. Thank you. so I guess we're going to close. And, you know, again, I want to thank the group for allowing us to have this speaker series. And we have one more week here. So please come back next week and bring a friend. And we'll close with Roseanne's prayer.